This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Christianity, in its many forms as we know it today, is based on the 27 books of the New Testament. But we get conflicting views of Jesus Christ's life and teachings from the recently rediscovered ancient Gospels that were excluded from the canon. My guest, Bart Ehrman, is a scholar of neglected and recently rediscovered ancient Christian writings. He has two new books. Lost Scriptures is a collection of writings from books that did not make it into the New Testament. Some of the translations are his own. In the book Lost Christianities, Ehrman examines these non-canonical writings and analyzes what they tell us about the various forms of Christian faith and practice in the second and third centuries. Ehrman chairs the Department of Religious Studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Many of the non-canonical works that you've collected and written about in your two new books belong to three different schools of thought. Let's talk about what those three different schools are. Let's start with the Ebionites. Who were they?
The Ebionites were Jewish Christians. They started out as Jews who followed Jewish customs. They were born Jewish, probably, followed Jewish customs such as circumcision, observance of the Sabbath, kosher food laws, and such. But these Jews had come to believe that Jesus was the Messiah. They accepted Jesus as the Jewish Messiah sent from the Jewish God to the Jewish people in fulfillment of the Jewish law. And so they understood that to follow Jesus, a person needs to be Jewish. That meant that the Gentiles, the non-Jews converting to the faith, according to the Ebionites, had to become Jewish. The men had to be circumcised, and men and women had to keep kosher and observe Sabbath and such. And so they were a Jewish group within early Christianity.
So they didn't see Christianity as a break from their Jewish faith, just as a new development within it.
Yeah, they saw Christianity as the fulfillment of the expectations of Judaism. And they maintained, since this was the Jesus was the Jewish Messiah sent from the Jewish God, that obviously this is still a Jewish religion. And so they retained the Old Testament as their scriptures and had other scriptures that did not eventually make it into the canon, but other Gospels, for example, that they said were inspired and authoritative that emphasized the Jewishness of Christianity.
Now, what about the Marcionites?
The Marcionites stand at the other end of the spectrum theologically from the Ebionites. The Marcionites followed a teacher from the second century named Marcion, who was a famous theologian philosopher, who had as his hero the Apostle Paul. Paul had said that a person is made right with God apart from the Jewish law, and Marcion pushed this to an extreme, saying that there's a difference between the law on the one hand and the gospel on the other hand, that the law is given by God in the Old Testament. It's a harsh law that nobody can follow, and so there's a penalty for not following the law, which is death. This harsh, vengeful God of the Old Testament is contrasted with the God of Jesus, who is understood to be loving and merciful, who's come to save people from their sins rather than to condemn them for their sins. Marcion concluded, therefore, that there are, in fact, two different gods. There's the God of the Old Testament and the God of Jesus and Paul. And so he wasn't a monotheist. He believed in two gods, and he rejected all things Jewish as coming from this other God, the wrathful God of the Old Testament.
Do you think that there's anything from that basic premise that survived into the canon?
Well, the hero of Marcion, of course, is the Apostle Paul, as I said, and Paul's writings form a central component within the New Testament now. Paul has more books attributed to him than any other author of the New Testament. And I think, in fact, that this Marcionite view continues on in some churches unknowingly today, where people continue to talk about there being a difference between the Old Testament God of wrath and the New Testament God of love. That was the original view propounded by Marcion.
One of the groups that some of these writings fall under is the Gnostics. Who are the Gnostics?
Well, the Gnostics are a little bit hard to describe because there are a number of early Christian sects that scholars have lumped together under that term, Gnostic. The term Gnostic comes from a Greek word, gnosis, spelled with a G, G-N-O-S-I-S, gnosis, which means knowledge. These people are called Gnostics because despite the differences among them, they all emphasize that knowledge is the way to salvation. The basic Gnostic system appears to have maintained that this world we live in, this material world, is not the creation of the one true God, but in fact is a cosmic disaster that happened, and that people are trapped spirits. Spirits have been entrapped here in human bodies and need to escape this evil material world. And the way they escape this evil material world is by acquiring the proper knowledge, the gnosis, necessary for salvation. In these Gnostic religions, for many of them, Christ is the one who comes from heaven to reveal this knowledge that can set people free from bondage to their bodies.
One of the best known of the Gnostic Gospels is the Gospel of Thomas, which includes over 100 sayings of Jesus, and some of them are very similar to sayings that appear in the New Testament, but they're, on the other hand, kind of different from them as well.
Yes.
One of the really interesting ones that you quote is a variation on "Seek and ye shall find." Do you want to read what the variation is in the Gospel of Thomas?
Yeah, this gospel was a fairly recent discovery. It was uncovered in 1945 with a collection of other works near a town in Egypt that's called Nag Hammadi. And so these books are sometimes called the Nag Hammadi Library. They contain 52 different books that appear to be Gnostic in their orientation. So this was a terrific find because it was the first time that we had a large number of original documents from the Gnostics themselves, including this Gospel of Thomas, which has 114 sayings of Jesus, some of which, as you said, are very much like what we find in the New Testament, but others of which are quite different. There's some sayings that sound like the New Testament, but then they start to have an interesting twist at the end. For example, this one you're referring to, saying number two, it goes like this. Jesus said, "Let him who seeks continue seeking until he finds. When he finds, he will become troubled. When he becomes troubled, he will be astonished, and he will rule over the all."
How would you interpret that?
Well, it sounds a lot like the saying in the New Testament, "Seek and ye shall find," but then it has this funny twist that when somebody finds what they're looking for, they become troubled. Then after being troubled, they become amazed or astonished, and then they rule over the all. I take this to be a Gnostic saying that once one finds the true secret of one's identity, that one in fact doesn't belong here, that one is a spirit that comes from the divine realm and has been trapped here in a mortal body, well, that's a troubling discovery that leads to amazement. But once one is amazed and has full knowledge of his or her identity, then one has the opportunity of returning to the divine realm itself, where the person will, with the other divine beings, rule over all there is.
I don't know if this is fair, but the New Testament, "Seek and ye shall find," sounds more almost like a self-help homily, whereas the Thomas one sounds more like a Zen koan.
Yeah, there's something to that. The New Testament, I think, really, the "seek and ye shall find," is actually more geared toward answers in prayer. The idea is that whatever you ask shall be given you, whatever you seek for you shall find, and whenever you knock, the door shall be opened. But the person providing that is God, so that God is the one who allows you to find and to have your prayers answered. Whereas here, it really does seem more internalized, that you discover who you are, and as it turns out, you are a divine being who has the power to rule over all there is. So it does have more of a kind of an Eastern Zen-ish feel to it.
Let's talk about some of these early books and what some of their different interpretations are. Let's start with the divinity of Jesus. What do the different sects of Christianity that these books are from say about the divinity of Jesus? Is he the Son of God? Is he divine himself? Is he merely a man?
This is one of the hottest debated points in early Christianity. Today, of course, Christians tend to say that Jesus is both divine and human, both God and man. But in early Christianity, there were wide-ranging debates over who exactly Jesus was. This group called the Ebionites, this group of Jewish Christians, maintained that Jesus was completely human and only human, that he was born to the sexual union of Joseph and Mary, that he was like the rest of us, only he was more righteous. And since he was more righteous than the rest of us, God chose him to be his son and appointed a task to him to be the one who would die for the sins of others. So in that system, Jesus is completely human and not at all divine. contrast that with the Marcionite Christians, who maintained that Jesus was completely divine. He was one who came from the good God to save people from the wrathful God of the Old Testament, and he didn't belong to the God of the Old Testament who created this world. Since he didn't belong to the God who created this world, he couldn't be part of the creation itself, which means, for the Marcionites, he was never born. In fact, the Marcionites maintained that he descended from heaven as a full-grown human in the appearance of human flesh, so that he was, in fact, a phantasm, fully divine and only seeming to be human. And so these are two opposite extremes, one saying he was fully human and not divine, the other saying he's fully divine and not human. And other people wanted it both ways, saying, yes, he is fully human, but he's also divine. He's divine, but yes, he's also human.
What about the Gnostic texts?
The Gnostics have a particularly interesting understanding of it, because they understand that there's something divine and human about Jesus. And so what they maintain is that Jesus Christ is two things, that Jesus is a man like other humans who was born into this world, who was a righteous man, and the Christ is a divine being that comes down from heaven to inhabit the body of Jesus, so that the Christ is different from Jesus. The Christ is a divine being inhabiting Jesus' body during his ministry. That's why he doesn't start doing any miracles until after his baptism for these people, because that's when the divine Christ came into him. And then at the end of his life, since the divine element cannot suffer, since it's divine, Jesus at the end cries out, my God, why have you forsaken me? Literally, my God, why have you left me behind? It's because the divine element at that point, according to the Gnostics, had left Jesus and returned to its heavenly abode. So for them, Jesus Christ was two things, and there's a separation between the Jesus and the Christ.
How do the early sects of Christianity explain the birth of Jesus? Are there virgin birth stories in the other early sects?
Some of the early sects maintained that that Jesus was born of a virgin, and in what I would call proto-Orthodox circles, in other words, the circles that held to the views that eventually became Orthodox, even in these proto-Orthodox circles, there are traditions about Jesus' miraculous birth that are somewhat different from the traditions we find in the New Testament. There's a very interesting early text called the Proto-Gospel of James, which is allegedly written by Jesus' own brother, James, in which there's an account of of Mary giving birth, and when she gives birth, Joseph, narrating it in the first person, actually sees time stand still. He sees that sheep aren't moving in the field and birds aren't flying through the air, and humans are frozen in space just as the Son of God is being born. He goes off and according to this proto-Orthodox story, the proto-Gospel of James, Joseph goes off then to find a midwife in order to assist with the delivery. When the midwife arrives, the child's already been miraculously born. The midwife doesn't believe it, however, and decides that she needs to give a physical inspection of Mary, a postpartum physical inspection, to see if in fact she really was a virgin. And she gives her a postpartum inspection and it turns out not to have been a good thing, because then her hand starts burning off in judgment for disbelieving that the virgin has given birth. Jesus, then, the infant Jesus, ends up healing her hand, so it all works out well in the end. This has to do with the idea that Mary continued to be a virgin even after Jesus, as is a doctrine, for example, in the Roman Catholic Church, that Mary was a perpetual virgin, and so this is part of that, an early narrative description of that idea.
And what about Jesus' death and resurrection? How do the early sects that you were describing describe his death, and do they believe in his resurrection?
Well, it's a really good question. These different groups had different understandings of the death and the resurrection. There were some groups, of course, who said that Jesus' death is what brings about the salvation of the world. That would be the proto-Orthodox view. There were other people who said that Jesus died, but his death had nothing to do with the salvation of the world. For example, the Gospel of Thomas, these 114 sayings of Jesus that appear to be Gnostic in their orientation, they think that the way to have eternal life is by understanding Jesus' secret teachings. His death has no role to play in salvation. There were some Gnostic groups that maintained that when Jesus died, it was just the man Jesus who died, that the Christ had left him to die alone on the cross so that the divine element didn't suffer at all. There are other Christians who maintain that since Jesus was fully divine and not really human, that he didn't have a flesh and blood body, so that he didn't die at all, that it was just an appearance to deceive the enemies of Jesus, the demons and the devil, but in fact, Jesus himself never actually died.
And heaven and hell and afterlife, did the early Christian sects, the three main ones that you were describing earlier, did they believe in an afterlife and in heaven and hell the way Christians have come to understand it?
Well, I think many of these sects did believe in some kind of heaven and hell. Some of them believed, though, that instead of there being a heaven and hell for individuals in the afterlife, the idea that you die and your soul goes to heaven or hell, some of them, for example, the Ebionites, appear to have thought, held to the view that may have been the original Christian view, even the view of most writers of the New Testament, namely that that it isn't salvation for the individual soul, but that God is going to bring a new kingdom here on earth, and that eternal life will be an earthly life in which the sin that happened in the Garden of Eden is reversed, and we live here in paradise forever. Or if for those who are not among believers, they are banished from this paradise forever and suffer eternal punishment.
And the others?
Well, it's hard to say about the others. The Gnostics are the most interesting group because the Gnostics maintain, some Gnostic groups maintain that there are three kinds of human being. There one kind of human being is made up purely of animals, just like your pet cat or dog, or just like insects or other animals. When these animals die, and that's the end of the story. So you squash a mosquito, and the mosquito's gone forever. Well, some humans are like that. They're pure animals. They die, and that's it. A second group of humans, according to these Gnostics, were people who could have an afterlife if they had faith and good works. It would be a good afterlife. It wouldn't be fantastic, but it would be pretty good. This afterlife is reserved for people who are Christian, who do good works and have faith. But then there's a third group, the Gnostics themselves, who are the insiders, who have insider knowledge, who learn who they really are as sparks of the divine. These people, once they acquire the knowledge necessary for salvation, they're entitled to an afterlife that's fantastic. That'll be a return of the spirit to the divine realm that it came from in the beginning.
How did the texts that are in the New Testament become the canon? How come the other texts didn't make it in? Who decided? What was the process like?
Well, it's an interesting process, and people who have thought about it have sometimes concluded that there must have been some kind of vote taken among bishops of the churches. There must have been some kind of church council where it was all decided. And in fact, that's not how it happened. There were long, drawn-out debates over which books should be included and which should be excluded. In the second and third Christian centuries, so 100, 200, 300 years after Jesus' death, there were Christian groups who held to the canonical standing of books that eventually didn't make it in. Some Christians thought the Gospel of Thomas should be included, or the Gospel of Peter, or the Gospel of Philip. Others maintained that other apocalypses, such as the Apocalypse of Peter, should be included, or a book called The Shepherd of Hermas. Some people didn't think the book of Revelation should be included, or the book of Hebrews. So there were these long, drawn-out arguments. It's interesting and quite shocking to many of my undergraduate students, to learn that the first person ever to list our 27 books as the 27 books of the New Testament and no others, the first person to do this was a man named Athanasius, who was a powerful bishop of the Church of Alexandria, Egypt, who wrote a letter to his churches in the year 367, in which he listed the 27 books that we have. This is the first time in history that anybody listed our 27 books and only our 27 books, so that it took over 300 years before the canon was put into some kind of final form. And there continued to be debates long after Athanasius, into the 4th and 5th centuries, as Christians continued to disagree.
Were the texts that didn't make it into the canon suppressed?
Yeah, well, once it was decided which books were to be included, there was also a decision that the heretical books had to be destroyed and taken away. That's why we often don't have the original writings of many of these early Christian sects, because they were destroyed on the order of some of the bishops. I should say something about how the Christians decided that these 27 books would be instead of some others. We do have discussions in early church writings about how to decide which books to include. And the early Christians seem to follow four major criteria for judgment. First, a book had to be ancient if it were going to be included, so that if a really good Christian book were written just a year or two ago, that isn't good enough. It has to go way back to the time of Jesus and his apostles. Secondly, related to the idea of it having to be ancient, a book had to be written by an apostle or a companion of the apostles. Now, some of the books were anonymous, which created problems. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, for example, don't claim to be written by people named Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. That's the titles they have, but whoever gave them these titles was trying to say that this is the gospel according to Matthew. That isn't something Matthew himself would say. He would just say this is the gospel. What happened is Christians in the early second century started saying these anonymous books actually are connected with apostles. Matthew is the disciple, the tax collector. John is the beloved disciple. Mark was understood to be the secretary of the apostle Peter. Luke was understood to be the traveling companion of Paul. And so they attached names of apostles or companions of the apostles to these anonymous books so they could be accepted, because books had to be not only ancient but also apostolic. The third thing is that books had to have widespread usage throughout the world of Christendom in order to be accepted into the canon. And fourth and finally, books had to be orthodox, meaning they had to agree with the correct understanding of the faith to be included, so that a book like the Gospel of Peter or the Gospel of Thomas ended up being excluded precisely because these books were understood not to represent the orthodox faith.
The group that you describe as proto-Orthodox in early Christianity is the group that's closest to what is in the New Testament. Who was this group?
Well, it's a somewhat amorphous group in that we know of some people who belong, but it's probably a fairly large group with many differences among them. We call them the proto-Orthodox because they represent the points of view that eventually became dominant in early Christianity, that eventually became Orthodox, but these people were living before this victory that they won, and so we call them proto-Orthodox. These are people like Ignatius of Antioch and Clement of Rome and Tertullian, and names that many students of early Christianity would be familiar with, although they're not household names any longer. These are people who insisted on certain theological points of view. They insisted that there's only one God. There's not two or 12 or 30. That Jesus is his son who's both human and divine. He's not just human. He's not just divine. He's both. These are people who developed the idea of the Trinity, that God is in three persons. There's only one God, but this God is manifest in three persons. These are the people who developed the creeds that eventually got formulated by the 4th century, creeds that continue to be recited by Christians today, the Nicene Creed and the Apostles' Creed. They're the ones who decided which books would be in our 27-book canon, these 27 books and no others. And they're the Christians who decided how the churches would be run. They insisted that there would be bishops over churches, and eventually that there would be bishops over the bishops, and eventually that there would be one bishop over all, the Bishop of Rome, who eventually then becomes the Pope. So these are the people who insisted on points of view that became dominant in Christianity and that determined the shape of Christianity for the ages to come down to our own day.
Was it the only Christian group that had a hierarchy like that?
There were other Christian groups that did have hierarchy, but the proto-Orthodox especially emphasized their hierarchy, and they used their hierarchy to good advantage because the bishop was able to call the shots over the church. This relates to the formation of the canon because bishops tended to be the most educated people in their congregations. Most people in the ancient world couldn't read. Probably at this time period, something like 10% of the population was literate. which creates an interesting irony for early Christianity because it's insisting that its religion is based on written texts, but these written texts would be ones that people, by and large, were unable to read. The bishops, however, could read and could interpret. And so the interpretation of these texts by bishops, by leaders of the churches, then, are what's determining what Christians believe. So there's some kind of interesting connection between high literacy rates and leadership in these early Christian churches.
And was there any connection, do you think, between the hierarchy in the proto-Orthodox church and the fact that that's the group that kind of won out in terms of the dominant approach to Christianity?
Yeah, the way I see the process working itself out in early Christianity is that there were a wide range of groups who believed a wide range of things and had a wide range of practices. And eventually, one of these groups acquired more converts than others. It's a group of Christians that we're calling the Proto-Orthodox who had a base in the city of Rome. There were more Proto-Orthodox Christians in Rome than other kinds of Christians. Rome, of course, was the capital of the empire. Some people think that because this kind of Christianity was explicitly in Rome, that that was a certain advantage that they had, that the Roman Christians, under their leader, the Bishop of Rome, tried to assert their influence over other churches in surrounding areas and then eventually throughout the world, so that by investing this bishop with certain kinds of power and then getting like-minded bishops in other neighboring churches then throughout the world, this group was able to establish itself as dominant throughout Christendom.
If the New Testament is in part a way to make the teachings of Christ consistent and to do away with some of the contradictory sects, do you find it interesting that in spite of that, there are still so many different approaches to Christianity that have flourished?
Well, it's extremely interesting. Christianity's always had kind of two movements, one toward unity and one toward diversity. And these two movements seem to happen simultaneously. So that the idea of creating a canon of Scripture was to create a unified text that could be used as an authoritative witness to how Christians should believe and practice their religion. But this unified text that emerged is 27 books written by different authors to different audiences at different times. And in fact, there are different viewpoints found among these 27. By putting them between one hardcover, set of hardcovers, the proto-Orthodox Christians were hoping that that would stabilize the religion. But since there's so much diversity even within the New Testament, the ploy didn't really work because there are different viewpoints found in the different Gospels, for example, and between Paul and Matthew and between the book of Revelation and the Gospel of John, different viewpoints that different Christians latched onto, leading to, again, more variety within early Christianity, so that today, even Christians who all subscribe to the notion that there's a 27-book canon of Scripture can disagree on the most fundamental things of the faith, including things like what is an appropriate form of baptism, what is one to believe about the divinity of Christ. I mean, major issues that can't be resolved even on the basis of these canonical texts.
Bart Ehrman is my guest, and he's the author of two new books about the early Christian texts that did not make it into the New Testament. One book, Lost Christianities, is about those texts, and the second book, Lost Scriptures, excerpts some of those texts. How did you become interested in the early non-canonical texts?
Well, when I was in graduate school, two things were happening that sparked my interest. One was I became increasingly interested in the diversity of the New Testament itself. I had started out as an evangelical Christian, thinking that the text of Scripture was completely inspired and without any error. But as I started working on these texts, reading them in the original Greek language, studying them intensely, I started finding wide-ranging differences among these books. And soon I started seeing contradictions in the text, and I started seeing that these different authors had different perspectives, including perspectives that were at odds with each other within the pages of the New Testament. At the same time I was finding that, I became interested in other books not found in the New Testament. I started studying the Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of Peter, books that are called the Apostolic Fathers, such as the Shepherd of Hermas or the Epistle of Barnabas. And I began to realize that that Christianity outside the canon was even more diverse than Christianity within the canon. And so these two elements of my study are what really sparked the interest that culminated in these two books that I've written.
In your own studies, when you realized that there was such diversity of reporting among the different early texts about Christ, was that did that become a crisis of faith for you?
Yeah, for me personally, it did lead to a crisis of faith because unlike a lot of my friends who were studying the same material, my friends didn't have the kind of evangelical belief in the inerrancy of the Bible that I had. Their faith was rooted in something else other than a particular doctrine about the Bible. But since my faith had been rooted in evangelical teachings about the Bible, once I started realizing that there were discrepancies in the Bible that I simply couldn't resolve without having to do a lot of very fancy footwork, I decided that the Bible wasn't the inerrant rule of faith and practice that I had assumed. And for me, this led to a real crisis, an emotional crisis of faith. But it's interesting that my friends at the time, I happened to be at seminary, Princeton Theological Seminary. My friends at the time learned everything I learned and would agree with most of the things that I think and continue to be solid believers, but it's because their faith wasn't built on some understanding of the inerrancy of the Bible.
Okay. Can you speak at all about how you resolved that crisis of faith or how your understanding of Jesus Christ has changed?
Well, I think what I've come to is a realization that that Christianity, above all, is a historical religion that makes historical claims about a historical person, about Jesus of Nazareth. And so it seems to me that whatever a person happens to believe theologically, that Christians are obligated to consider their religion historically, and that historical knowledge about Jesus, about the time he lived, about what his apostles did after his death, about the books that they wrote, the books that were forged in their names, about all of these things. All historical knowledge is important for people who have a historical faith, and that historical knowledge can threaten faith, and it may threaten to change a person's faith, but it's not a bad thing because this is a historical religion, and historical knowledge can deepen the understanding of this religion precisely because it's such a historical faith.
Can you explain again what you mean by a historical religion?
Well, there are a lot of religions that aren't based on the life, teachings, and death of an individual, but Christianity makes claims about Jesus, that Jesus was born at a certain time, that he taught certain things, that he did certain things, that he died under Pontius Pilate. These are claims that a historian could look at to see whether Jesus really did do these things. Did Jesus really say these things? Did he really die when Pontius Pilate was the governor of Judea? The faith is based on these historical notions. I'm not saying that the faith is only historical. In other words, it's not that Christians are, by their very nature, historians, but the faith that they have depend on historical information, which means that it's subject to historical investigation. So that the investigation of historians into the beginnings of Christianity does have relevance to what Christians believe.
Would you consider Judaism and its connection to the Old Testament a historical faith?
Yeah, in some ways I think it is. I think that traditionally Judaism, even though it also is historical because there are historical narratives in the Hebrew Bible, but Judaism doesn't have as heavy a emphasis on theology as Christianity has. And it's the theological claims of Christians about the historical person Jesus that creates this interesting tension between belief and history. because Christians make theological claims about a historical person. Whereas in Judaism, it doesn't quite work that way, because Judaism has traditionally understood itself to be a living tradition that that changes according to circumstances over time. And so the historical components of Judaism aren't quite as central to the Jewish faith as the Christian historical claims are to the Christian faith.
What's been the most interesting discovery since you started studying these early texts?
Well, there continue to be discoveries all the time. One would think that there we would get to a point where nothing else would be discovered. But in fact, there are books discovered all the time. Just the most recent one was discovered by a couple of American scholars tucked away in a library in Berlin. It's a Coptic manuscript that they've entitled The Gospel of the Savior. They just published it a couple years ago. It's not widely known to people, but scholars know of it. It's a really interesting text because it's a text which describes Jesus' last hours in which he actually has a conversation with the cross. And he tells the cross not to fear. Soon he will mount up upon it and bring salvation to the world. And he has this back and forth. But the other interesting scene is that Jesus, during his prayer in Gethsemane, is actually transported up to the throne of God. And he and God talk it over about what he's going to do. When Jesus says, "Let this cup pass from before me," he's actually in the heavenly throne room having this discussion with God. So all the time there are these not all the time, but on occasion, there are these discoveries, and they each have to be given careful consideration because they all reveal the rich diversity of early Christianity.
Since we're about to celebrate Christmas, it would be interesting to hear what some of the early sects believed about how Christ's birth should be celebrated.
The idea of celebrating Jesus' birth wasn't prominent in any of these early Christian groups that we know of. What was celebrated was his death and his resurrection. And so there were commemorations of his death and resurrection from the earliest of times among a variety of sects who would celebrate Easter in a variety of ways. But it's not really until the 4th century with the Emperor Constantine that people start thinking about Jesus' birth as being a moment to celebrate. And the reason the birth becomes important for celebrating in the 4th century is because theologians began to emphasize that at his birth is the time in which God became man. And so that moment becomes very important. But when the sects are battling out over their different perspectives in the 2nd and 3rd centuries, the celebration of Christmas really wasn't even an issue.
Well, Bart Ehrman, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Bart Ehrman has two new books, Lost Christianities and Lost Scriptures. He chairs the Department of Religious Studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Here's Dave McKenna playing O Little Town of Bethlehem.